You're listening to Tuck's Gift, a special issue of Historical New Hampshire, first published in 1992 and reprinted in 2011, in celebration of the centennial of the New Hampshire Historical Society's 1911 building.
The Education of a New Hampshire Philanthropist by Franklin Brooks. The years roll around and the last will come when I would rather have it said he lived usefully than he died rich. Benjamin Franklin, 1750. During the summer of 1938, the New Hampshire towns of Hampton and Exeter celebrated their founding 300 years before. It was also a season to remember Edward Tuck's benefactions and to mourn his death on April 30th, 4 years short of his own centenary. On the seacoast, the center of Hampton's festivities was the Meeting House Green, where the town museum stands. The adjacent Founders Park commemorates Hampton's earliest families, including Edward's ancestors on both his parents' sides. They had migrated from Massachusetts and beached their boats in the salt marshes north of the mouth of the Merrimack River. The tricentennial's athletic events and pageant took place on the Tuck Memorial Field. The park, the museum, and the athletic field were Tuck gifts to the town made in the 1920s and 1930s. A few miles inland, Exeter's Tuck High School, the Exeter Hospital, and Cincinnati Memorial Hall were open to visitors and displayed Tuck's picture. Phillips Exeter Academy, from which he graduated in 1858, eulogized him for his generous support. On the Hanover Plain, overlooking the Connecticut River, Dartmouth College paid homage to its most generous alumnus since its founding in 1769. A member of the class of 1862, he had endowed the Amos Tuck School in his father's memory and strengthened its financial well-being with innumerable gifts. In Concord, in the shadow of the gold-domed state capitol, the granite headquarters of the New Hampshire Historical Society reflected his desire to preserve the legacy of the state's history. Most people whose lives the Tuck largesse had touched had never even seen him. He died in Monte Carlo, and his funeral took place in Paris. His wife, Julia Stell, who shared his devotion to philanthropy, had predeceased him in 1928. The dedication of the New Hampshire Historical Society in 1911 had brought them to New Hampshire for the last time. By then, they were permanent residents of France. In Paris, they kept an apartment at 82 Avenue des Champs-Élysées. West of the city, in Rueil-Malmaison, they owned the chateau that they called Vermont. In Monte Carlo, they spent their winters in a large penthouse apartment whose windows faced the sea, the mountains, and the Italian and French Rivieras. The Tuck's friends did not, however, call them expatriates. Through all these years, Edward had honored New Hampshire's political history and its institutions. Having seen the United States become a world power in the decades following the Civil War, he assumed that New Hampshire must have a share in the nation's destiny. Dartmouth's history was inseparable from the state's. When a 1904 fire destroyed Dartmouth Hall, the historic centerpiece of the campus, he contributed to its rebuilding and wrote to his friend, President William Jewett Tucker, "No institution within its limits has brought to the state throughout its history such credit and honor as has Dartmouth College. We, the loyal sons of New Hampshire, can give no better evidence of our undiminished affection for our native state than in honoring the college and helping as best we may to so fortify its position that its future may be worthy of its glorious past." Edward Tuck's ancestral roots were in New Hampshire. His mother, Sarah Ann Nudd, came from Hampton. His father, Amos Tuck, might have been born in Hampton as well, had his parents not decided to participate in an ill-advised farming venture in what is now southern Maine. As a teenager, Amos came to Hampton to attend school on his own, trusting an education to free him from an unrewarding life on the land. After graduating from Dartmouth in 1835, he became a lawyer, an investor in railroads, and a founder of the New Hampshire anti-slavery movement. From 1847 to 1853, he served in the United States House of Representatives and opposed the Democratic majority's compromise with the Southern faction. During his first term in Congress, he became friends with Abraham Lincoln. The year of his return to private life saw the Know-Nothings rise to power. To meet this threat to mainstream New Hampshire politics, he called like-minded members of the Whig, Free Soil, Independent Democrat, and Liberty parties to a meeting in Exeter's hotel, the Squamscott House on Front Street. The likely claim has been made that to unite them, he was the first to suggest that they call themselves Republicans. In 1859, he recommended a year's course of study at Phillips Exeter for Lincoln's eldest son, Robert, who hoped to attend Harvard. Robert was a guest in the Tuck home, and Edward helped him choose a boarding house in town. At the Chicago Convention in 1860, Amos delivered New Hampshire's Republican delegate votes to Lincoln. As a reward, Lincoln appointed him the naval officer of the Port of Boston, the second most powerful and profitable patronage prize in New England. It paid him a salary and gave him a percentage of all fines, forfeits, and seizures collected in the Boston port. Following Lincoln's death, he lost the position and returned to private life once more to his law practice, his investments, and his philanthropies. In their youth, other men Amos's age had turned their backs on agriculture in favor of industry, education, the law, and politics. Like many young men of privilege in the next post-war generation, his son Edward chose not to study law. He rejected politics and chose to remain in the private sector as a financier and member of the leisure class. There is no evidence of his even visiting Washington after Lincoln's inauguration in March 1861. He shared this indifference to public life with the sons of other men to whose lives the earlier struggle to eliminate slavery and preserve the Union had given meaning. Robert Lincoln, for instance, Henry and Charles Francis Adams, Jr., Henry and William James, and Daniel Chester French. As cosmopolitan writers, world travelers, scholars, Wall Street tycoons, and artists, these latter contemporaries helped American public-mindedness redefine itself during the last decades of the century. Edward and Julia's private philanthropy is another expression of this trend, all the more remarkable because they practiced it as conscientiously in France, their second home, as in this country. Yet Edward's private achievement was founded on a unique opportunity, on a single brief tenure in government service. During the last years of the Civil War, President Lincoln appointed him consular pupil and then acting vice consul in Paris. Had the State Department been able to offer him civil service status and protection from the uncertainties of political favor, he might have remained in the diplomatic corps. Instead, at the age of 24, he joined a firm of international bankers, Monroe & Company of Paris and New York. In the American colony in Paris, he met and married Julia Stell, an orphaned heiress who had been raised in England and France. Nothing is known of her natural parents. Her adoptive father, William Shorter Stell, a Philadelphia merchant banker based in Manchester, England, included among his friends George Peabody, the most influential American philanthropist of the 19th century. A native of Massachusetts who spent his mature years in England, Peabody accumulated an immense fortune as an international banker and stock market speculator. In 1854, he took Junius Spencer Morgan into partnership, a move that made the Morgan Empire possible. For years, he and Stell provided services to each other. In Paris, his correspondents were Edward's employers, the American partners of Monroe and Company. Following the untimely death of Stell and his wife, Julia lived in Paris with one of those founding families until her marriage. Less than 15 years later, Edward Tuck was sufficiently wealthy to retire from banking. Thenceforth, he managed his own fortune and Julia's, expanding their holdings in banks, ore fields, the petroleum and electrical industries, and, above all, in James J. Hill's Great Northern Railroad and associated companies. Although Edward and Julia never had children of their own, they provided for the well-being of several generations of Tuck relations. The stock market crashes of the Gilded Age left them unharmed, but sensitized them to the contradictions of an increasingly diverse nation in need of a new unity. They acknowledged that the right to possess wealth carried with it a responsibility to improve society. Their role was clear. Andrew Carnegie defined it in The Gospel of Wealth, the preferred title of his 1889 essay. To administer their fortune as a public trust during their lifetime instead of making their heirs wealthy or entrusting someone else to send their bequests to institutions as seemed fit. Edward must have known about Carnegie's views, but no evidence of that knowledge appears to exist. His only reference to Carnegie, to come to light, concerned whether the New Hampshire Historical Society should ask Carnegie for funds. Edward opposed the idea, stating that they should furnish their own funds and build their own building. "It was a disgrace to die rich," Carnegie told a friend. His essay honored philanthropists of the new breed and recommended seven areas in which one's surplus wealth could be spent most effectively. The Tucks' record of giving conforms strikingly to the spirit of these recommendations. 1. The founding of a university or the expansion of those in existence, particularly in the study of astronomy. 2. The establishment of free libraries, art galleries, and museums. 3. The creation of hospitals and medical schools. 4. The provision of public parks. 5. The construction of public halls for meetings and concerts. 6, the provision of men's and women's swimming baths for health and exercise. And 7, the building of churches for social and aesthetic rather than sectarian purposes. Carnegie's reasoning about beauty anticipates the tux, even in its language, as we shall see. The millionaire should not figure how cheaply this structure can be built, but how perfect it can be made. If he has the money, it should be made a gem, for the educating influence of a pure and noble specimen of architecture, built as the pyramids were built to stand for ages, is not to be measured by dollars. Carnegie was addressing the new American millionaire class to which the Tux belonged, and which numbered some 4,000 members by one estimate in the 1890s. Edward, in turn, expected his fellow millionaires to fill the ranks of philanthropy without hesitation. He explained to Principal Lewis Perry of Phillips Exeter, "I have helped Dartmouth as largely as I have in the past because it had almost no millionaires among its alumni. It is getting more of them now." Edward's generation strove to make life easier for the able and industrious. Beginning about 1890, the Tux supported schools, athletic facilities, hospitals, monuments and museums, and historical institutions in New Hampshire and in France. They believed that philanthropy would strengthen the social order by offering people the means to improve themselves, to enjoy good health, to become self-reliant, to understand the American heritage, and to make the United States second to none in the conduct of business, industry, and finance. The buildings that housed these services and bore the Tuck name must be of architectural distinction and be decorated, when appropriate, with rare and beautiful things, most often French. Such aims linked them to other philanthropists of their generation, including J. Pierpont Morgan and John D. Rockefeller. In 1886, Edward became director of Rockefeller's Chase National Bank, which eventually became the distributor of all the Tuck monies. Edward and Julia knew four generations of both Morgans and Rockefellers and shared charity projects in New York and France with them. Only the Tucks, however, applied what they had learned and what they believed to the needs of New Hampshire. It was these efforts, above all, that the citizens of that state strove to honor in the summer of 1938. Occasionally, Edward and Julia contributed to the protection of natural sites for the enjoyment of future generations. In a town neighboring Exeter, Stratham Hill was a popular picnicking area, famous for its view of the surrounding countryside and the distant ocean, and the perfume of its wild strawberries in the summer. The Tucks bought it and gave it to the town in 1905 to protect it from developers. When the Society for the Protection of New Hampshire Forests and the State of New Hampshire brought Franconia Notch and the Great Stone Face into public ownership in 1928, Edward contributed to the purchase fund. Notably absent, however, is a Tuck commitment to New Hampshire's religious life. On July 29, 1914, the New Hampshire Historical Society dedicated a 40-foot-high granite obelisk to the Reverend John Tuck, whose ministry lasted some 40 years on Star Island, the most prosperous of the Isles of Shoals, located 10 miles off the New Hampshire coast. Tuck was a Hampton native, descended in a collateral line from Edward's ancestors. By this time, his tomb had fallen into disrepair, so Edward agreed to pay for a bronze plaque and then the obelisk as well. Engraved on its face, Jedediah Morse's testimony, dated 1800, affirms that Reverend Tuck was affable and polite in his manner, amiable in his disposition, of great piety and integrity, given to hospitality, diligent and faithful in his pastoral office, well learned in history and geography as well as general science, and a careful physician both to the bodies and the souls of his people. The lesson seems to be that Tuck was to be honored more for his benevolence than for his spirituality. American philanthropists of Edward's father's generation had striven to improve the welfare of chronic indigents and criminals, the poor and vicious, and to help states adopt enlightened means of administering public schools, prisons, reformatories, insane asylums, orphanages, and schools for the handicapped. Amos's example was foremost in Edward's life, yet Amos does not seem to have entertained any ambitions of private philanthropy, relying instead on education, politics, the law, and government to affect the general good. During and shortly after his years at Dartmouth, he was a teacher and served briefly as principal of Hampton Academy. Once his law practice was well established in Exeter, he served as a trustee of the Phillips Exeter Academy from 1853 to 1879. When the Exeter Female Academy became the Robinson Female Seminary in 1867, offering tuition-free instruction to women on a par with the academies, he wrote its constitution and served as a trustee and the first president of the board. From 1857 to 1866, he was a Dartmouth trustee. Amos's closest Exeter friends shared his concern for the practical needs of their community. Joseph G. Hoyt was a professor of Greek and mathematics at the academy who taught young Edward. He and Amos were the principal proponents of building Exeter a new town hall in the early 1850s, and he spoke at its inauguration, praising the value of architectural beauty and commodiousness for the common good. It was there that Lincoln gave a campaign speech in 1860. Lawyer Henry Flagg French of Exeter was a friend of them both. Once, Tuck and French found themselves alone in a town meeting during a snowstorm. They proceeded to adopt a motion to plant the streets of Exeter with elm trees. French went on to become a judge, the first president of the Massachusetts Agricultural College, now the University of Massachusetts, and an assistant secretary of the United States Treasury. His son was the sculptor Daniel Chester French. A nephew, Francis Ormond French, married Edward Tuck's sister Ellen. The creation of the new New Hampshire Historical Society headquarters was one of several occasions when Edward and Daniel collaborated as patron and artist. When Daniel unveiled his equestrian statue of George Washington in Paris on July 3, 1900, the Tucks gave a festive banquet for him that evening at Vermont. Although their methods were different, Amos and his son shared a commitment to the public good. In remarks prepared for the opening of the New Hampshire Historical Society, Dartmouth's President Tucker, who knew both Amos and Edward, said this, "No like instance occurs to me in which father and son have been so much at one in the purpose of their lives, and at the same time so successful in expressing this purpose in such different ways, as appears in the public careers of Amos and Edward Tuck. Amos Tuck gave to this state and to the country the rare personal gift of loyalty to conviction, a gift which contributed powerfully to the redemption of the state of New Hampshire from the political domination of the slave power, and ultimately to the redemption of the nation from the grasp of the same power. It was the most timely gift which any man at that time had the power to bestow. The same principle of estimating himself according to his relation to the public good which actuated the father has manifested itself in the son through the unselfish and far-reaching use of personal possessions." President Tucker spoke for the young generation in his appeal for support from the private sector. In these same remarks to be read in Concord, he recalled the decision to purchase land among the public buildings around the State House for the Historical Society's imposing structure. For him, this location was a pleasing image of the Commonwealth. There, City Hall represented the municipality, the State House and the State Library, the State of New Hampshire, and the Federal Building and the Post Office, the federal government. For Tucker, the presence among them of the New Hampshire Historical Society symbolized the emergence of private philanthropy in civic life. It represented the most personal aspect of citizenship, that kind of loyalty which is allowed to work in personal ways and with personal distinctions for the state and for the good of institutions of every sort. About the time that Carnegie's Gospel of Wealth appeared, Edward decided to join the ranks of these philanthropists. Although he was approaching 50, it might not have happened but for Tucker himself. The two of them had roomed together one term. Tucker was Edward's only college roommate. He became president of Dartmouth in 1892. His election represented a movement on the part of young alumni alienated by the traditional values and beliefs of President Samuel C. Bartlett. Tucker's inauguration address in June 1893 aligned the aims of his liberal arts college with the new order of American education, encompassing the discipline and learning skills acquired in high school and the advanced research programs available in the new universities, such as Leland Stanford's in California and John D. Rockefeller's University of Chicago. He sketched his plans for the modernization of Dartmouth, the development of new programs in the natural sciences, the hiring of new faculty, and the design of a campus that would integrate landscaping and new buildings for each department or program. He invited postgraduate programs to associate themselves with the Dartmouth community, as the Thayer School of Civil Engineering and the Medical School had done. At the same time, he acknowledged the important role alumni must play, especially in raising an endowment. Two alumni trustees in particular shared his dream and eventually established cordial relations of their own with Edward. Benjamin Kimball, president of the Concord and Montreal Railroad, the Boston and Maine's New Hampshire subsidiary, and Frank S. Streeter, the B&M's counsel. Both men were also energetic board members of the New Hampshire Historical Society. They and their associates were the sort of men whom Edward respected, bankers and lawyers, sometime members of the New Hampshire House of Representatives and Senate, all of them Republicans, and active on the boards of hospitals, public libraries, orphanages, and utility companies. No expression of interest in plans for Dartmouth came forth from Edward for several years. Then, upon hearing that Tucker was planning a sabbatical, Edward suggested a trip to Paris at his expense. Now, with no solicitation from the college, he offered it a substantial endowment in his father's memory. Part of its income covered library expenses and faculty salaries. Part provided financial security to several new departments, history, economics, and modern foreign languages, on a par with components of the old curriculum, ancient languages, English, mathematics, philosophy, and political science. Tucker persuaded Tuck to underwrite the expense of a graduate school of business administration as well, although its cost required additional gifts in the next few years. The first such school founded in the United States, it respected the college's commitment to the liberal arts while providing graduates with specialized, practical, to use Edward's favorite word, knowledge. The formation of the new school was announced at a meeting of the college on January 22, 1900. 30 students enrolled that fall. Mr. Tuck was the first of the alumni of means to identify himself financially with what had begun to be known as the New Dartmouth, Tucker wrote in his autobiography. Over the next 40 years or so, until his death, no one was Tuck's equal. He established amiable relations with Tucker's immediate successor, Ernest F. Nichols, and treated the next, Ernest M. Hopkins, like a son. Almost every year brought gifts from Tuck's stock portfolio, which included Chase, First National, later Citicorp, Tidewater Oil, Texaco, Northern Pacific, Great Northern, Northern Ore, and Electric Storage Battery. A general endowment fund in the form of Great Northern stock valued at $300,000 was his original offer to Tucker. Shortly afterwards, he gave an additional $125,000 in stocks for the construction of a building for the Tuck School. Larger and smaller gifts passed regularly into the college accounts. $500,000 in 1910, $105,000 in 1913, $180,000 in 1917, $320,000 in 1919, $60,000 in 1920, $133,000 in 1922, $200,000 in 1923, $133,000 and $725,000 in 1925, $50,000 in 1926, $700,000 in 1928-29, plus gifts in cash ranging from $3,000 to $20,000. With some of these funds, the college constructed Tuck Drive to provide automobile traffic with a new access to the Hanover Plain from the Connecticut River. Close to the drive, Tuck Gifts built and furnished the president's house. When Edward persuaded George F. Baker to build the Baker Library, which opened in 1928, its west entrance became the focal point of the mall now called Tuck Drive. And soon, ground was broken for the new Tuck School at the other end. The college wished to increase the school's enrollment to 150 students. In any case, the business administration program had outgrown the original 1903 building by then. This structure, part of the complex of buildings erected around the college green during Tucker's years, is now called McNutt Hall. The college architect, Jens Frederik Larsen, designed a new complex of classrooms, library, offices, dormitories, and refectory, which Tuck consented to build entirely at his own expense. Meanwhile, opportunities to acquire two library collections in French literature and Romance philology, and catastrophes such as the Dartmouth Hall fire or the shortfall in a year's income, resulted in further gifts. For years, Edward's generosity to Dartmouth remained unmatched. Over his lifetime, he spent $1 million on construction at Dartmouth. In the early days of Edward's renewed interest in Dartmouth, he and Julia established their residence in France. Until the outbreak of World War I, they came to the United States yearly, where they divided their time between a New York townhouse on East 61st Street and the family home in Exeter. Exeter was second only to Hanover in their philanthropic concerns in New Hampshire. It was there that Edward spent most of his early years. His mother gave birth to him on August 24, 1842, in an early 18th century wooden house, one of Exeter's oldest. This was the Tilton House at 72 Front Street. In 1906, Edward bought it and deeded it to the Academy. It was in another Tuck house on Front Street, built in 1853 at number 89, that Edward spent his adolescent years before college. After Amos died in 1879, Edward, who inherited the house, persuaded Amos's firstborn Abby to make a home there for herself and her daughter, Laura Nelson. In his will, Edward left the house to the Academy upon Laura's death. She supported charities of her own with her share of the family fortune, and died in 1955 at the age of 101. During the early 1900s, Edward turned his attention to the needs of Phillips Exeter Academy. In 1905 and 1909, he donated $10,000 and $5,000 to funds named for his father's old friends, George A. Wentworth and another Academy teacher, Bradbury L. Silly, respectively. On the first occasion, Wentworth wrote to a mutual friend, "How much good Ned Tuck does with his money." Edward's interest in the Academy was further quickened by the renewal of his acquaintance with Edmund J. Curley, a classmate from 1856 to 1858. The two men were reunited in 1896. Curley had become a whiskey distiller in Kentucky and president of the Distillers Securities Corporation. Upon retirement, he divided his time between New York and Newport and then moved to Monte Carlo. During World War I, it pleased these friends to combine their gifts to the Academy. When the Academy building burned down in 1914, they contributed $15,000 to the $200,000 rebuilding fund. In 1917, they established the $200,000 Tuck Curley Class of 1858 Endowment Fund, the largest unrestricted gift that the Academy had ever received. Curley died in 1921, and after this, Edward felt inclined to entrust the Academy's good fortunes to an increasingly large number of prosperous alumni. Meanwhile, the Tucks contributed to other needs in the town. Exeter had no hospital until 1897, when private citizens raised funds to lease a large frame house. Edward's sister Abby and a neighbor hosted the first fundraiser, a garden party, at their adjoining homes on Front Street and on the grounds of the Robinson Academy behind them. The very day the cottage hospital opened, a railroad accident confirmed the need for this 10-bed facility. With passing time, its insufficiencies became obvious. In 1906, a new hospital offered 18 beds, an operating room, and housing for three nurses and a matron. Edward and Julia donated more than a third of its building costs, totaling $30,000, and built the Tuck Home for Nurses on adjacent land. After the hospital was expanded to 50 beds in 1924, they enlarged the nurses' home. Insufficient space and inadequate public funds plagued the boys' high school in Exeter, where classes had not been coeducational since the Robinson Female Seminary was established in 1867. The schoolhouse, into which the students still crowded, had been scarcely improved since its construction in 1848. The town approved Ralph Adams Cram's plans for a new one in 1911. Cram had graduated from Exeter High School, and soon the Academy would put him in charge of its campus design. Cram chose the Georgian Revival style for the high school, the Academy's Davis Library, which he was designing at the same time, and the new Academy building, to which Tuck and Curley subscribed. Eventually, the Academy, like Dartmouth, became the embodiment of what Americans think a New England campus should look like, with its 18th-century style buildings in red brick, marble, granite, and slate, symmetrically arranged around lawns and greens. Cram laid the cornerstones of the high school and library on the same day, October 26, 1911. The completion of the high school necessitated an appeal to the Tucks, however, who contributed $5,000. In their negotiations, Edward's spokesman was John Templeton, editor of the Exeter Newsletter. The Exeter Public Library preserves two of Edward's letters to Templeton. In one, he agrees to the name Tuck High School in his father's memory. In the other, he chastises the town for skimping on costs and for accepting anything less than first-rate plumbing. The $1,000 he enclosed was to be spent, he said, for final completion of the building with all practical perfection in every detail. This statement is the quintessence of Tuck principles. When an addition to the high school was needed in 1928, Edward contributed $10,000 toward the cost. In 1906, at its annual meeting in Exeter, the New Hampshire Society of the Cincinnati elected Edward to honorary membership. Founded in 1783 by George Washington's officers, the Society's 14 constituent parts included the original colonies and France. Recently revived, the New Hampshire Society was already seeking ways to express its historic mission, to affirm the values of the American Revolution, to honor the nation's link with its oldest ally, France, and to educate others about New Hampshire's role in the birth of the nation. At the time of his election, Edward was becoming well known not only as a benefactor to his birthplace and to Dartmouth, but also to France, and as a spokesman for improved Franco-American relations. Since he was not descended from an officer of the Continental Army, he was not eligible for hereditary membership. The New Hampshire Society of the Cincinnati's early members had left a legacy of documents, including the first and second printings of the United States Constitution and a broadside of the Declaration of Independence printed in Philadelphia by the official printer John Dunlap, one of 23 copies known. Reconstituted in 1896, the Society remained in Exeter, the revolutionary capital of New Hampshire, and purchased the Ladd Gilman House for its headquarters. Thenceforth called Cincinnati Memorial Hall until it became the American Independence Museum in 1991, it sits on land adjacent to the Academy near the Squamscott River. A large brick house built around 1721, enlarged in 1752, it was the home of the state treasurer Nicholas Gilman during the Revolution. His son John Taylor became governor of New Hampshire. Another son, Nicholas Jr., was an original member of the Society and a delegate to the Constitutional Convention. It was his copies of the Constitution and annotations that the Society treasured. Several years after acquiring the Gilman home, the organization purchased the 1775 Folsom Tavern, where its founders had held their first meeting on November 18, 1783. New responsibilities came with these distinctions. The house and the tavern required restoration, decoration, and maintenance, roof repairs, brickwork, new heating equipment, and a fireproof vault. The grounds needed landscaping. For more than 30 years, Edward contributed to all these expenses. He subscribed to the purchase and maintenance of Memorial Hall 4 years before he became a member, and later to the expense of moving the tavern onto a neighboring lot and restoring it. His annual gifts of several hundred dollars covered current expenses and taxes. He gave half the sum necessary to purchase the only letter that Washington is known to have written to the New Hampshire Society of the Cincinnati. He created an endowment with 200 shares of Northern Pacific stock, which produced up to $1,000 income per year, except in the worst of the Great Depression. Unlike Hampton, Hanover, and Exeter, Concord was a place of little personal importance to the Tucks. Edward and Julia were likely to think of Concord as the home of their friends, Kimball and Streeter, Judge Charles Robert Corning, and the Historical Society's treasurer, Henry Webster Stevens, who married Edward's niece, Ellen Tuck Nelson. It was these men who focused the Tuck's attention on the need to protect the New Hampshire Historical Society's collections. Amos had been elected to its membership in 1853 when he retired from Congress, yet Edward did not become a member until 1909, several years after he had begun discussions about new headquarters for the Society. The New Hampshire Historical Society was the fifth oldest state historical society in the country. Governor Levi Woodbury had given it its charter in 1823, with a charge to collect and preserve manuscripts and documents relative to the history of the state, its government, its people, and its institutions. For some 70 years, these collections had been housed in unsuitable quarters: the State House, a Masonic Lodge, and a bank. By 1900, the Society owned 17,000 volumes, 60,000 pamphlets, and numerous manuscripts. The president of the Society, who was most anxious to see a new building rise beside the State House, was William C. Todd. A Dartmouth graduate of the class of 1844, he had known Amos and had seen Edward in Hanover in 1860. Shortly before his death in 1903, he interested Edward in the project. Subsequently, Benjamin A. Kimball, who would soon chair the building committee, became the Society's link with Edward. In 1905, he visited the Tucks in Paris to discuss a $100,000 building. It eventually cost several times that much. In 1907, Edward and Julia visited the selected site in Concord and saw the architect Guy Lowell's preliminary plans. Edward gave $10,000 to purchase additional land, and later that spring, Kimball took Lowell's revisions to Paris and obtained the Tuck's approval, provided that Lowell use granite for the exterior instead of brick. Kimball returned with Edward's statement, "I want this building to be pure Greek, embodying the best of its kind in architecture and artistic beauty, and in all its appointments to be unsurpassed, making the structure ever a joy to visit. Mrs. Tuck and myself want the building to be the best of its kind, of distinctive character, and of the best design." Lowell's design helps us interpret the phrase pure Greek, which Edward may have borrowed from Kimball. The design was characterized by pleasing geometrical forms, monumental sobriety to the point of severity, and the harmonious interplay of architecture and sculpture. A variety of plain and variegated marbles would cover the walls and floors. Bronze was used to cast the monumental doors at the entrance, the memorial plaques, the electrical lighting fixtures in the shape of Greek lamps and vases, the window frames, and hardware. The railings in the rotunda and on the staircase and the library shelves were to be of brass, the furnishings of mahogany. These opulent materials suggested not only the value of the treasures that the building must protect from fire and dampness, but also eternity's victory over time. On the exterior, everything was to be made of the same smooth-finished gray granite from the Rattlesnake Hill Quarry in Concord. In form and spirit, the design of the building reflected the revolution in style launched by the World's Columbian Exposition in Chicago in 1893 and exemplified by the Lincoln Memorial that Henry Bacon designed in 1911 for French's colossal statue. The story of the Historical Society's new building provides a rare glimpse of Julia's role in the Tuck beneficences. Unlike Edward, throughout her life she granted no interviews and authorized no biography. None of her financial papers, and only a score of her letters, survive. Corning's unwritten history of the New Hampshire Historical Society building never refers to her. Newspaper accounts and Edward's correspondence suggest that her chosen areas of concern were hospital services, care for mothers and children, and the needs of single working women. In the United States, she often participated in subscriptions, fund drives, and committee endeavors to support milk kitchens and the Fresh Air Fund. In Rueil-Malmaison, she established a school of home economics where 100 young women learned to become self-reliant. The school is now a public lycée. She administered a home for working women in the Passy district of Paris and a private fresh air program for Paris's children. Improvements in hospital design were of particular interest to her and Edward. By the turn of the century, the discoveries of Louis Pasteur, Joseph Lister, and Ignaz Philipp Semmelweis necessitated new standards of hygiene. She built a 24-bed hospital for Rueil-Malmaison with her own fortune and named it for her mother. In the 1990s, a resident of Rueil-Malmaison still remembered her daily visits during the summer season. Driving in an open carriage, her back straight as a poker, she was the very picture of Britain's Queen Mary. We hear her voice, however, in Kimball's unpublished memoranda on which Corning based his book. Kimball's notes attribute a vigorous role to her in the conception of the Society's project. His account of the Paris meeting in 1907 is as follows. After a few days' discussion with Mr. Tuck, Mrs. Tuck said, "I think we had better say to Mr. Kimball that the best construction and design is none too good. We ought to have the best." Mr. Tuck said, "All right, I agree." At this time, it was decided that the building should be pure Greek in design. I informed Mr. and Mrs. Tuck that this would entail many more technical details not heretofore considered and would increase the cost very materially. They said, "Correct, we will build this building the best of its kind, and you will proceed to erect it as suggested, avoiding publicity as far as possible." Kimball recalled that when the Tucks visited Concord and found the proposed site too small, Julia said, "How much will it cost to buy that brick house?" Kimball told her that it cost too much and that the Society's appropriation was insufficient, but she replied, after discussing the matter with Mr. Tuck, "Buy it." When Lowell proposed a marble entrance hall, she said, "Edward, let's have this the best," and reiterated, "The best is none too good for this building." That standard of hers became proverbial. Timothy P. Sullivan, the construction superintendent, when faced with objections, was fond of arguing, "I know Mrs. Tuck would decide this or that, as the case may be, as she always wanted the best of its kind." Eventually, the Tucks made further gifts to the new building, including works of art of historical interest. Busts of Amos and Edward, of Benjamin Franklin and William Shorter Stell, filled niches in the rotunda originally. Amos's was a bronze version of Daniel French's 1881 posthumous portrait that he had repeated several times in marble. The State Library next door owns Ellen Tuck French's marble copy. After the opening of the Society's new building, Edward presented Chester Harding's life portrait of Levi Woodbury and the Revolutionary War flags of the 2nd New Hampshire Regiment. A British officer captured the flags after the fall of Fort Ticonderoga in July 1777, and Edward purchased them from descendants in England. The Tucks were bitterly disappointed, however, not to be able to give all their art treasures to the Society. Their collections of French and English 18th-century decorative arts, Flemish primitive paintings, Gobelin and Beauvais tapestries, Sèvres dishes, and exceptionally fine Famille Noire Chinese porcelains had been assembled with the guidance of Lord Joseph Duveen between 1900 and 1910 and were valued at $5 million. They were the furnishings of the Tuck's apartment in Paris. These treasures are pictured in a book Edward authorized in 1910, Some Works of Art Belonging to Edward Tuck. Only 50 copies were printed as gifts. The Tuck's intention was to give it all to the Society for educational purposes, and Lowell was engaged to design a museum wing for it. Lord Duveen displayed a model of it in his gallery. Suddenly, in 1920, new French laws placed prohibitively high export fees on art treasures. Reluctantly, but with great presence of mind, the Tucks decided to make the gift to the city of Paris instead, with an endowment of 1,000,000 francs. In 1930, the objects were removed from the Tuck home and installed in new galleries in the Petit Palais Museum, where they can be admired today. In gratitude, the city of Paris gave Edward its gold medal and made him a citizen of the city, an honor reserved for heads of state and luminaries like General John J. Pershing. The Légion d'honneur elevated Julia to the rank of officier and Edward to that of commandeur. Before his death, he received the Grand Croix, the highest honor a private citizen can enjoy. The president of the French Republic, Gaston Doumergue, attended the opening of the Tuck galleries. The fact remains that Edward and Julia intended these art treasures to be preserved, studied, and enjoyed in Concord, not Paris. In France, several such official honors had been bestowed on the Tucks since the turn of the century. Julia's funeral in 1928 and Edward's in 1938 were state functions, attended by representatives of the government and of the ministries of fine arts and education, ambassadors, members of the Institut, escorted by the Garde Républicaine. Paris newspapers enumerated the titles, prizes, and medals they had received. The two of them had come to represent for the French what was best in American private philanthropy, in war and in peacetime. They sought to remind the French that the maintenance of good relations, consecrated by a long history, was in the mutual interest of both nations. To a remarkable degree, their beneficences have survived in France no less than in New Hampshire. In 1938, some may have rightly wondered whether anything of value would be left standing at the end of the decade. Winds of catastrophe swept across Europe, America, and Asia, like the September hurricane of that year, which ravaged New England's forests and uprooted the trees along many a town's streets. 1 in 5 American workers was unemployed. Many of Edward's stocks paid no dividends to the institutions that held them. Hitler annexed Austria and advocated autonomy for the Sudetenland. When German forces mobilized and France called up its reservists, the likelihood of war was undeniable. The Munich Accords agreed to the division of Czechoslovakia, and Kristallnacht foreshadowed an unprecedented reign of terror. Yet more than half a century later, the Tuck's legacies still affirm their faith in social progress through the reconciliation of private wealth and public need, the ability of individuals to manage their fortunes efficiently and altruistically, and the power of private institutions to improve society by means of education, medical services, and culture. Meanwhile, the face of philanthropy continues to change with the emergence of foundations and nonprofit organizations. These days, government is making more and more appeals to the private sector, principally corporations, to share the burden of social services. Nevertheless, some innovations of the Tuck's era are still viable today. Living donors' gifts surpass bequests more than tenfold. Religious organizations receive the largest single share of dollars of all, but funds for education, the environment, international agencies, and the arts are increasing. At the end of his life, Edward observed that the well-being of Dartmouth was every graduate's concern. In 1937, he summed up his feelings about Dartmouth in a statement distributed to all alumni. That year marked his 95th birthday and the 75th anniversary of his Dartmouth graduation. It reads, "At each remove, I drag a lengthening chain. The senior alumnus of Dartmouth finds himself, as the years pass, more closely attached than ever to his alma mater, the benign mother of his youth. His country college of the late 50s has become a beacon of light and learning, visible from beyond the oceans, as well as from every corner of our land. The fame of Dartmouth burns now with a steady glow even across the world. You can imagine my pride. My joy is immense at the thought that I may stand, for a moment, side by side with our great President Hopkins when he appeals to Dartmouth's loyal sons to help in extending further still the range of their influence. We can imagine, too, the pride of that one of us whose name none can ever forget and who perhaps is watching us from the shades, our venerated President Tucker." Edward's first sentence echoes Oliver Goldsmith's poem, The Traveler, which admonishes us to learn the luxury of doing good. When Edward drafted this letter, a new era of philanthropy, exemplified by the growth of college alumni associations, had begun, and appeals were being made to increasing numbers of people united in a common interest. Today, the Tuck name is still used in such appeals, and not only at Dartmouth, to extend the luxury of doing good even to those of moderate means. The millionaire philanthropist has become everyman.
Franklin Brooks was associate professor of French at Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee. He was working on a biography of Edward and Julia Tuck at the time of his death in 1994. The Tuck family papers are preserved at Dartmouth, where Brooks taught from 1964 to 1969. He also published articles about the Tucks' philanthropies in France, about the friendship of Edward's father, Amos Tuck, with Abraham Lincoln, and about Dartmouth's Amos Tuck School of Business Administration. You've been listening to Tuck's Gift, a special issue of Historical New Hampshire, first published in 1992 and reprinted in 2011 in celebration of the centennial of the New Hampshire Historical Society's 1911 building, sometimes referred to as New Hampshire's Temple of History. Historical New Hampshire, the only statewide history journal, has been a regular publication of the New Hampshire Historical Society since 1944. Tuck's Gift is a multifaceted program of the New Hampshire Historical Society, presented in documentary, printed, audio, and online versions, in collaboration with the New Hampshire Humanities Council and New Hampshire Public Television. The audio version of Tuck's Gift is narrated by John Walters and produced by Jody Peterson at Cliff House Audio for the New Hampshire Historical Society. Music composed and performed by Colin McCaffrey or used by permission of New Hampshire Public Television. Tuck's Gift, made possible with generous support from Merrimack County Savings Bank, the Mackininch Foundation, Rath, Young & Pignatelli, the New Hampshire Antiques Dealers Association, Swenson Granite Company, Unitil, Capital Offset Company, the Gertrude Coote Trust, the H.L. Turner Group, and the Ann DeNicola Trust.